In the end, Kolya doesn't have to make the case for action. "We're going to need a couple of darts and a lot of explosives," John says, turning on his heels and walking back inside the house in darkness. Rodney catches up as John riffles through the papers on his desk, disturbing stacks of pictures and knocking Ben's handmade penholder to the floor. He bends to pick it up and stores it safely away in a drawer. "John," Rodney says, standing stiffly by the desk, "do you realize what... You can't think this is... I mean, yes, of course, we have to stop them, but it doesn't have to be... What do you think I should do instead?" He finds the pages of diagrams folded under his tablet PC. "Sit in this house until the kitchen knives start to look good? What the hell do you want me to do, Rodney?" We need you... God, don't make me do this. "Do what?" "Talk you down from a ledge," Rodney says, white-faced and grim. "I won't know where to start, and I'll say all the wrong things, all the meaningless things, and it isn't like I could ever get you to do anything you didn't want to do, except for that one time when I destroyed a solar system, so please, please, don't." That slows John down a little. "I'd never make you do that," he says, meaning it. "Now look at this." "Look at what?" Rodney asks unevenly, glancing at the rough sketches spread on the desk. "You mapped the Hive ship?" "As much as I could. You've been on board, too. You've worked on their systems, hacked their mainframe, learned their vulnerabilities. You can fill in some of the blanks." "Well, yes, I can," Rodney says, flipping through the well-worn pages and reaching for a pencil. "But we don't even have to target neuralgic centers. If we can smuggle a team on board, all we need is a small nuke, or to overload an aqueduct generator anywhere inside the shields." John shakes his head. "No. If other Wraith come to investigate, or anyone escapes, it can't look like it came from us. It has to pass off as sabotage."
"I can help a little with that," Ekaterin contributes quietly, stepping into the living room ahead of Kolya and Nofert, Taylor and Ronan standing watchfully at the back.
"Yeah," John says softly, holding her gaze. "You can."
First contact is tentative, bittersweet as a childhood memory of schoolyards and scraped knees. This other Atlantis is a shy old girl, sad and immense and almost pitiful. It would have been kinder to let her sleep, to not wake her for this arranged marriage. But the whole neighborhood showed up to witness the union. Janai and Elysians, and other hard-eyed, starry-eyed men and women on one side, the remnants of an Atlantean team on the other. Bride on the left, groom on the right, an assembly of revelers and worshippers holding their collective breath on the floor of the control room. Laying hands on the consoles, John feels like a traveling preacher seeding false hopes in the hearts of simple men, coaxing the appearance of life out of dead things. "Stay down," he wants to tell the city, wishing she could share her own hard-earned wisdom. "Play dead. Don't let them see you bleed." But there is a new ZPM connected to the power matrix. Kolya didn't have to kill for it, he said. Screwing Sunira did the trick. And the doors open, and the lights come on. John doesn't hang around to watch Orathai and her scientists start crying over the technology of the ancestors. Any minute now, they'll be shoving their fingers into ancient toasters and ancient vacuum cleaners, looking for the ultimate weapon, looking for a miracle, and that's too much deja vu for John. Standing cool and still as statues, Kolya and Nofert watch John from the bottom of the stairs, as if for his next trick John would part the sea of sand outside the city's walls and lead their flock to some promised land. But John isn't a leader, and he isn't a savior, and neither is the city or anything in it. They are both of them tired, broken creatures, and there's no point getting them to see it. Ignoring Kolya and Nofert's black stares, John stalks past Taylor and Ronan, and around Rodney, who looks ready to renounce the lure of diagnostic consoles and new labs to follow him. "Knock yourself out," John says, shaking his head sharply, and Rodney says, "Do you want me to?" But John looks away from Rodney's worried face and whispers, "Please, Rodney, don't." He hasn't been above begging for a long time, though he's never been looked at like he was fragile before. "Find me when a Katarin comes through," he adds quietly, and slips out of the control room unchallenged, if not unnoticed. Their plan is hatched. There is nothing to do but wait. Where will she find the Wraith darts? Kolya had asked John over the hive ship's blueprints, eyes narrowed in suspicion. And why, in the name of the ancestors, would you believe a Bajarian citizen is qualified to pilot them?
There's a leech for every occasion, John had answered flatly, but Rodney had caught John's gaze and held it, because he understood.
Of course Rodney did. Would have known within hours of setting foot on Bajan. He must have felt like screaming and pointing the whole time, yet he had kept silent. He had been there for Ben and John. It's early morning on this nameless planet, in this nameless city, when John finds himself at the top of the eastmost tower, feeling the strain of the jog up the stairs in his knees and his thighs. He stands against the railing and watches the pale morning light creep beyond the skyline, over the rocks and the sand and the slim patches of tall gray grass. The sky is indigo blue and uninterrupted, and he already knows that he could come to love this place and the people in it, the hard-eyed, starry-eyed men and women in the control room, though he entertains no thought of either staying or leaving. He wants to concentrate on the mission, what he has, what he needs, what he's got to do. As the coolness of the desert night recedes, the heel of his hand comes to rest on the sidearm Katerin gave him before they left Bajan. John forgot about it. Stopped missing the faithful weight of a weapon months ago. He pulls it out of the holster and balances it in the palm of his hand, and turns it this way and that. It's a perfect replica of his old standard-issue 9mm, but he forgot to put the safety on. It seems impossible. He was handed a weapon, and he didn't check it, didn't clean it, and forgot to put the safety on. On some level, John understands that this should scare him more than it does. Sitting on the floor, he lays out the gun. He doesn't have a full kit, but he finds in the pockets of his Bajarian-issue tack vest a clean cloth that he rips in two for cleaning and polishing, gun oil, solvent, a thin metal rod of unknown origin that can be used as a barrel rod. Kit laid out, he disassembles the firearm, first ejecting the magazine, working the action and locking it open, checking the chamber for bullets. Once he is certain there's no ammunition left in the gun, he holds the recoil spring plug down and rotates the bushing to the left. He can hear Frank Shepard as if the man were standing next to him. "Keep your finger on the plug, Johnny. You don't want the spring to launch it across the room, or you'll have a hell of a time finding it." His father taught John how to clean a gun when John was 10. His mother had offered comments over his father's shoulder, and his father had yelled at her for backseat driving. The memory makes John smile, though he isn't aware of it. After taking the recoil spring plug out and setting it aside, John shifts closer to the wall. The city is warm, stored-up heat soaking through his shirt along his shoulders and his back, through his camos along his thighs. He closes his eyes and lifts his face to the sun. He shouldn't get distracted in the middle of stripping a sidearm, but his neck muscles feel heavy and cold, and he shivers despite the heat. Maybe he's coming down with meningitis. He wonders if he can get it twice. He came down with viral meningitis when he was 12. He doesn't remember much about it. It was years before he understood just how touch-and-go it had been. He remembers that, in a startling development, his parents had been stationed together that whole year, and there had been a lot of yelling. If it weren't for the U.S. Army, their marriage would never have lasted. Separate assignments, the occasional deployment, teaching posts, never staying in one place long enough for the novelty to wear off, for familiarity to breed contempt. Military life had held them together effortlessly. They hadn't even bothered applying to the married couples program. As they moved through the ranks, they'd become little more than placeholders to each other, a commonality that Rachel and Frank Shepard could very well call love. By the time he'd joined the Air Force, John had lived in twice as many bases as the average military brat. Taking to the sky, he'd looked down at the people specks on the ground, and had seen placeholders there, too. Startled, John opens his eyes. He must be more tired than he thought. Maybe he should go back inside, pick a room, take a nap. But his sidearm lies disassembled on the floor, and he still has to clean it. Take out the slide stop, take out the slide, pull out the spring, remove the bushing, push the link forward, remove the barrel out of the slide. His kit doesn't include a brass brush. Upon further investigation,
His vest also yields a first aid kit which includes what look like condoms, possibly flavored, and a plastic toothbrush. John sets aside the condoms and keeps the brush. He's gotten pretty good at improvising since he left Earth, beyond anything S.E.R.E. or Frank Shepard could have taught him. From assuming command to turning an alien city into a defensible military outpost, from converting spaceships into submersibles to raising a child in a prison cell, from making Christmas decorations out of pebbles to finding the right words to scare away the wraith under the bed, from needing Ben more than he's ever needed anyone to surviving Ben's death. John remembers a day when he stood on the dais of a stargate with the Katarin and wondered if Ben would become a burden. Hauling himself to the railing, John bends over and vomits long streams of bile. When Ronan and Rodney find him, his sidearm is still guttered on the floor. "I'll take care of it," Ronan says. And Rodney says, "A Katarin is here. We're ready." And John wonders what's on his face that makes them both look away. "Look for the manual release of the airlock at 10 o'clock. Look for the manual release of the airlock at 10 o'clock. Look for the manual release of the airlock at 10 o'clock," John thinks, and there is no perceptible transition between the moment he stands under the dart in the launch bay of the city and the instant he rematerializes in the black of space. There is a short burst of absolute primeval panic, of complete disorientation that almost has him shouting for a Katarin inside the helmet of his pressure suit when he finds himself suspended in darkness, the only source of illumination the tiny light inside his visor. He flails instinctively for a handhold, for air, for resistance, for a tether, except, of course, that his sluggish struggles against the buoyancy of weightlessness can't even be called flailing. "Oh, shit," John gasps, the words almost inaudible over the thunderous echo of his own breathing. He shuts his eyes tight and counts to 5 before opening them again. Ahead of him is a vast infinity of darkness. Rolling his head slowly, he looks down toward his feet and catches a glimpse of the starfield. Oh, wow. Now where the hell is that hive ship? Reaching for his belt, John activates his mobility unit in small bursts until he's turned most of the way around, and realizes that, 1, he's floating an arm's length away from the hull, on the dark side of the orbiting hive ship. 2, the rest of his team must have a pretty awesome view of the planet below. 3, a Katarin managed to beam him out right above the airlock, despite the limitations of passive sensors. 4, 10 o'clock may mean something on a schematic, but it means jack shit when you can't tell up from down. Firing the miniature thrusters of the mobility unit, John comes close enough to the hull to grab a handhold. He can almost feel the skin-like ridges of the ship's exterior through his glove. The Bajarian pressure suit, crisscrossed with hair-thin coolant and heating conduits, is barely thicker than 2 wetsuits worn together. Rodney had driven even the good-natured Katarin insane, freaking out about EVA radiation exposure and oxygen autonomy and micrometeoroid impacts. But as he searches the contours of the airlock door for the manual release, John is only grateful for the maneuverability afforded by the suit. When he locates the lever, John grabs the release mechanism and pulls, a thin rush of air escaping the seal as the airlock vents its atmosphere. Pulling open the hatch, John breathes hard, upper body unused to this kind of exertion, but he manages to swing himself inside, reseal the door, and hit the pressurization panel. Within moments, he is leaning against the inner hatch of the airlock, willing his legs to remember gravity. Lifting an arm that feels strangely alien, John hits the transceiver on the side of his helmet once. He gets 4 clicks in response. The others made it on board. John retrieves his sidearm from the pouch strapped to his thigh and exits the airlock. Inside the ship's dim corridors, the closed environment of the helmet is all the more claustrophobic, ambient sounds muffled and filtered through the communicator. John feels like a ghost, separate, out of sync with the world in the way he didn't experience in the dark of outer space. Keeping his back to the bulkhead, he orders himself sternly to keep it together. This is no different than entering a combat situation wearing hazmat gear. As he draws closer to the science quarter, John holds his sidearm with both hands and keeps an eye on the biometric sensor unit strapped to his forearm. He knows this place well. Three junctions to the right and one up are the cells where they kept the surrogate mothers. Two junctions to the left is the cell where he was held, isolated from the rest of the cattle. Further down this very corridor is the lab where Dick conducted his experiments. Off the lab is a small chamber, containing a single pod, where John spent 5 days on his knees. His primary objective lies deeper within this quadrant of the ship. Keeping to the maintenance corridors, John locates a ladder that leads one tier up. The section is deserted. After the battle with the rival hive, the command ship would have been patched up, then technical assets would have been sent out to repair the damage sustained by the carrier group. Ekaterin and the other Bajarian pilot are out there, two anonymous darts amid the swarm canvassing the wounded fleet. As long as no one trips an alarm or stumbles over a patrol, their stealth approach, no using detectable ancient technology, bypassing the docking bay, should be successful. The backup cooling system is located far off the main reactor core, in an undesignated section of the tier. Laying out the schematics of the ship's propulsion and decentralized backup systems during the pre-op briefing, Rodney had questioned whether the Wraith did have some experience with sabotage to explain these precautions. Ekaterin had said, "Not the Wraith," and Rodney had barely even opened his mouth before he got it. Kolya had almost spoken up then, but Rodney had cut him off, launching into a monologue on the comparative merits of explosives versus the more subtle, but potentially countermeasurable, overload of the cooling system's face capacitors. Explosives had won by a landslide. No one is guarding the alcove, and a visual inspection confirms that the web door isn't rigged. Once inside, it's easy work to pull the charges out of a second pouch, set the detonator, and hide them behind the membrane covering the cooling unit. Where doesn't matter. The blast will take out most of this section. Test completed, John sends out a click over the comm and sets out for his secondary objective. By the time he's down the ladder and back on the science tier, he's registered 2 more clicks. There's only 1 to go. He hasn't much time. John finds the mainframe access node in a small disused lab where Ekaterin told him to look. The station's commands are immediately familiar. Logging on as a root user, John calls up the directory, flicking through trees and running multiple searches on multiple terminals until he's located the relevant file system. When his radio channel crackles to life, John doesn't even pause. "Shepard!" Rodney's voice is distorted, too high by an octave. "What the hell do you think you're doing?" "Hi, Rodney," John says, inputting the equivalent of an LSAL more command. "How's it going starboard?" "As if I could tell left from right in here. As if I cared. What are you doing in the mainframe? Root user Uncle Sam. Yes, yes, very funny. How did you hack?" "Ekaterin snuck you a leech, didn't she?" "So much for radio silence," John mutters, scrolling through the file list. "Taylor and Kolya have set their charges, and I'm almost finished with the download. As soon as Ronan's done, I'm wiping out the mainframe and we're heading back to the airlock for retrieval. You don't have time to take a trip down memory lane, all right? I knew we shouldn't have left you alone." "I have to see them," John says. "There." He opens the file, scans the contents, memorizes the quadrant section alcove designation, and calls up the ship's schematics. 93 subjects in stasis. "No, no, absolutely not," Rodney squeaks in his ear. "What good is it going to do to see?" "I have to, Rodney. Keep to the plan. Don't worry about me." "I'm done, Shepard," Ronan breaks in, overlapping Taylor's. "John, you should not..." "Ronan, you get everyone out and you let your pilot set off the charges on schedule. Kolya, you make sure he does. Maintain radio silence. That's an order." John rattles off, running out of the lab. "I'll be right behind you." "Understood, Shepard." "No, wait!" John cuts off the rest of the chatter. Mentally reviewing the quadrant's layout, he makes his way to a maintenance ladder, going down. As he edges closer to the ship's larder, his bio unit lights up with multiple telltales, moments before his comm registers the wails rebounding off the walls. The sealed helmet should keep out the smell, but John's nose wrinkles at the stink of death and despair. When the sensors show a patrol gaining on his position, He slips inside a recess and hides behind its desiccated occupant, still trapped in its web. In a few minutes, none of this will matter. They'll have saved these people the only way they can. John makes it to the designated storage area undetected and covered in human dust. The slim oxygen pack is weighing more heavily on his shoulders, and his fingers and his lips tingle. He must be running low on air. Inside the chamber, the lighting is powered down, and the room feels cavernous, infinitely expanding upwards. A monitoring console stands in the middle of the floor. The stasis pods are set into the wall's black membrane and face each other in two half-circles embraced by the curves of the outer hull. The pods are lit from the inside, a dull yellow glow washing out the faces of their occupants. Up close, their skin looks pale and sickly, but it could be a distortion of John's visor or the pod's cover. The hair is longer. John hadn't expected that, but of course there wouldn't have been anyone to cut the thick mop into a semblance of submission over squirming and loud protest. Reaching out, John touches the transparent lid. He can't tell through the glove if the plastic is warmed by breath. The faces seem younger, rounder than in John's memory. They must not have been allowed to grow up at all. He can't be forgetting already. John moves on to another pod, and another, touching. It's right that he stay here until the end, that they not be alone. They're dying. Whirling, John raises his weapon. I'm not armed, Michael says, spreading his hands out, and I'm alone. Hive mind, John thinks, slipping his free hand in his pouch. Even if he kills Michael, it's already too late. Doesn't matter, though, now that his team is safe. I haven't alerted them, Michael says, reading John's mind. I couldn't if I wanted to. Now that Michael has stepped further into the chamber, allowing the doors to slide shut behind him, John can see that his eyes are sunken, his skin an unhealthy blue. What happened to you? John asks, honestly curious. A side effect of your generous treatment, Michael says, the casual shrug at odds with the sarcasm. I'm no longer joined with the Hive, among other things that are killing me. Dr. Heitmeier would be fascinated to learn that our scientists believe my ailment is psychosomatic. He cocks his head. Is this really better? This individuality? This constant humiliation? Always cowering, always suppressing your own desires, living in fear of being rejected by your own? John doesn't blink. I'm not the guy you want for this conversation. Really, Michael says, as if they were old friends chatting over a beer. I wish I'd had time to read more of your books while in Atlantis. It's been an edifying experience, observing my people from the outside, watching the extremes our instinct of self-preservation will drive us to. I come here often to think. Michael's expression shifts, and he stares at John with something like hunger. I should have named you and kept you. I would have had someone to talk to. I'm glad to find you here. That's why you didn't need us anymore, John says. When you let us go, they'd already cloned him. Michael doesn't answer. Heels clicking on the floor. He takes a step toward the console, and John shifts to cover him, gun arm heavy and shaking. Did you come to free them? Michael asks, indicating the pods. Our scientists have been going through the batch one unit at a time, trying to bring a subject to full growth, but they keep dying. The suspended animation is all that keeps these bodies alive. They suspect a degenerative byproduct of the cloning process. Ben's dead too, John hears himself say. Ah, I see. Michael slips his hands inside his sleeves, bowing at John like a confessor. Not free them, then. John twitches, and Michael smiles a little. I wouldn't stop you. It wouldn't matter if you tried, John says. He hefts the grenade inside the pouch, rolling it in his palm, feeling around for the slim bar of C4 he packed with it. Is she here? Michael frowns. Who? Your queen. Is she on board? Yes, Michael utters in one long hiss. But you'll never get within a tear of her. John doesn't reply. We're not so different, Michael says. I know, John says. People. creatures don't kill each other because they're different, but because they're alike. That's hardly news. Michael looks down at the console, studying the controls. Would you like to touch them? Well, as much as you can through your suit. Before John can think of an answer, Michael hits the release sequence. No! John shouts. He didn't want them conscious for this, didn't want to watch them die. Dropping his gun arm, John moves toward the pods, but he can't settle in front of a single one as all the covers slide open sideways, leaving the small naked bodies exposed. John watches numbly and feels his mind fraying, waiting for them to crumble at his feet, to open their eyes accusingly, to gasp or whimper or scream. But none of the bodies move. The monitoring LED of each pod flicks soundlessly from orange to blue. There's a kind of soft, collective sigh. And then they're gone.
Isn't this what you wanted?
Michael asks behind John's trembling back. He sounds wistful when he adds, I wonder if this isn't our one true freedom, choosing the manner and the time, going against the drive of our species. John stands surrounded by rows of small dead white faces, and the words wash over him, fault lines opening all the way through him. He lifts his hand and touches a 100 round cheek through the glove, but can't tell if it feels as waxy as it looks. He cards his fingers through the thick dark curls, curves his palm around a shoulder bony as a bird wing, trails his fingertips down to the unmoving ribs, the translucent belly. They look nothing like the memories of his dead, the dead children of his wars, who were never pristine and preserved, but gutted by shrapnel, or mowed down by bullets, or mutilated by bombs, dragged in pieces across a road, skulls leaking fluid, or hanged in blue, their eyes popping out.
John, may I call you John? Or would you prefer sir? Michael says, bitterness surging like bile, finally.
Still at the anger stage of dying, John notes distractedly. The monologuing stage, too.
Do you know what else I've come to realize? We defeated your ancients not because of our superior numbers, but because of their failure of imagination. They were stagnant, dogmatic and unwilling to fight when they could simply move on. They couldn't adapt their ways to our challenge. Now it's us who are incapable of change. This, Michael says, stepping up to John's side, sweeping his arm out to encompass the room. This is our failure of imagination. We are rushing toward extinction, but we will not go quietly.
No one ever does, John agrees, and turns and brings up his sidearm and lodges a bullet in Michael's right eye. As the body folds, a hollow explosion reverberates through the walls. The lights flicker, and the chamber heaves, spilling small white bodies on the floor. Another boom, not so muffled, precedes a third, and the whole ship screeches in pain like an animal.
Great timing, John mutters, dropping his weapon.
Pulling the hand grenade and the C4 out of the pouch, he molds the clay around the body of the grenade hurriedly and takes the pin off, firming his hold on the spoon. When the doors slide open and disgorge a swarm of drones, John doesn't stop to ponder whether they were waiting outside all along. He lobs the cooked-off grenade over his shoulder, toward an empty stretch of bulkhead, and throws himself between two stasis pods, grabbing onto a power conduit. The detonation punches through the hull like butter. Explosive decompression is instantaneous and catastrophic, deafening despite the helmet's filter. John manages to hang on just long enough to see the drones being sucked out through a breach wide enough to fit a car. Through the rapidly fogging and venting atmosphere, it seems to John like the living membrane of the ship is trying to reach out across the hole to mend the gaping wound. But none of that matters anymore, because the strain on his shoulders and his fingers become unbearable, and John lets go, wheeling his arms instinctively as he's jerked across the chamber, out of the ship and into space, a single black speck in a flock of small white bodies. John loses track of himself for a few seconds, consciousness weaving in and out. Almost immediately, the emergency setting of his mobility unit kicks in to interrupt his tumble. Orienting himself by the position of the hive ship, John is surprised to see how fast he's receding from it, with no wind or sound or resistance to provide a sense of velocity. He watches the collapse of the quadrant, not yet distant enough to see the whole thing. The hull is caving in where his charge took out a full section of the ship, vaporous atmosphere escaping in jets of steam. All around the structural damage, the hull skin appears to have blackened, the shadow spreading like gangrene. By Rodney's estimate, critical reactor failure will occur within 8 minutes of breaching containment once the coolant systems are compromised. Not long enough for the Wraith to do much of anything about it, but long enough for the other command ships to rush to their help and hopefully get caught up in the explosion. John drags in a deep breath and coughs. He's not worried that the shockwave will rip him apart and return him to stardust, because the hypoxia will take him out first. This lethargy creeping up on him, it can't all be Air Force cool. Blinking tiredly, John removes the disintegrating hive ship from view with a short burst. Above him, space stretches immense and black, the stars distant and unmoving, and he spreads his arms and legs sluggishly, floating on a dead sea. He's cold, but okay. It's kind of pretty here, so quiet and restful and beautiful. So he drifts a while, counting stars and the occasional wraith dart, and he wonders if the bitch escaped, and finds that he doesn't care as much as he thought he would, because a sudden burst of light illuminates the specks floating all around him, derailing all other thought. Firing his thrusters to the last of his fuel, John reaches out until he can almost touch one of them. Not quite, but it's enough. He can almost make out features, almost imagine warm skin instead of frozen flesh. The universe is good at killing children, John understands in that moment. It's clearly what it does best. As consciousness recedes, and the regulatory system of his suit sucks his tear ducts dry, John's sorry that he won't be around to tell Kolya they got it wrong. You don't kill the little girls, even if they're all yours. You save all of them, even if they're not. And in a flash, John Shepherd's gone. He's still breathing, Dr. McKay. He's starting to come to. There's no need to panic. Panic? You think this is panic? You haven't seen panic. He came this close to blowing up with the hive ship, and he was floating in space with the frozen bodies of... Oh, God, please, can you get that... it... him... get that thing off him! How did it happen? Rodney asks Katerin 3 days later, the words bursting out of him with all the vehemence of his earlier unnatural restraint. Lowering his voice, he frowns suspiciously, checking left and right for eavesdroppers. How did the Wraith get their hands on Bajarian technology? They sit at the terrace of a tea house up city, drinking black tea so strong it could strip off paint. The air is cool and crystal clear, glancing off the contours of Bajan's organic skyline, the silhouettes familiar and almost welcoming against their blue backdrop. The primary star is pinned to its zenith, and Rodney's nose, sunburned, is already peeling. Reclining in his chair, John breathes in the sweet smoke of a Katerin's rolled-up cigarette. "It's got something to do with the cloning," he murmurs, wishing the heat would soak all the way to his bones. "Doesn't it?" Yesterday on the hill, the sun had shone just as brightly, but John had been just as cold. They'd buried Ben on the promontory, overlooking the cities, and when Ronan and Rodney had lowered the small coffin into the ground, John had bitten his lip and drawn blood to stop himself from asking, "Are you sure? Did you check? How do you know that he's really gone?" After the ceremony, no words, tokens laid out by the mourners on the casket, the box of doll soldiers from John. Tail had scattered the ashes of Ben's anonymous brother, accidentally swept up by a Katerin's dart during John's retrieval, entrusting him to the wind. They'd returned to the house, and John had found the rooms as he had left them, full of Ben. Consigned to the porch, he sat with Taylor and made space for her own grief, while the rest of his team, and Nofert and the Katerin and Kolya, packed the last year of his life in boxes. Sighing, a Katerin puts out her cigarette in the bottom of her heel. "Cloning is a tricky process, you know, even for advanced civilizations. There's always going to be information loss, and in the long run, decay. It... Oh. My. God!" Rodney bursts out, aghast. "The Greys tried to transplant their consciousness into a living being? A conscious, breathing?" "Our friends," Ekaterin interrupts, and her expression grows fond, as if she were discussing harmless, if somewhat senile, relatives.
"They did consider," she begins, but deflates like a pierced balloon. "They came across a creature on a sparsely inhabited planet that was strong, long-lived, extremely resistant to damage, and cognitively underdeveloped as the result of an accidental mutation."
Rodney's expression is half horror, half sick fascination. "They forgot to factor in the hive mind."
Ekaterin nods reluctantly. "The first live trial was deemed a success. It looked like the host consciousness had been properly suppressed, and more transfers were initiated. But the collective mind of the hive took over eventually, and..."
"Everything that the transplants knew, every single wraith learned as well," Rodney says, wonderingly.
"That explains so much."
He holds up a finger to emphasize each point. "How their ascendancy could take the ancients by surprise despite their Pegasus origin. Why they're incapable of reprogramming their own ships, or devising new weapons against their own species, or managing human population levels properly. They don't have an original thought in their heads."
Rodney stares at Ekaterin. "You could give us blueprints of everything. We could devise countermeasures for their beams. We could..."
"I'm afraid that's not possible, Dr. McKay," Ekaterin says. "Our friends have a long-standing pact of non-aggression with the Wraith, which is the guarantor of Bajan's protectorate status. It cannot be compromised."
"What? That's outrageous. You could save millions rather than thousands, but you won't..."
"Rodney, chill," John breaks in quietly, raising himself out of his slouch.
"Oh, come on, Shepard. You of all people aren't going to defend the politics of non-intervention in the Pegasus Galaxy. I know I'm just a Canadian, UN-loving, gay-marrying, universal healthcare pinko commie to you, but I'm not that deluded. I work for the U.S. military."
"And you're making a lot of assumptions," John says with more force. "You haven't been here, so trust me when I say that the citizens of Bajan aren't doing nothing."
Ekaterin sits rigidly on the edge of her chair, her dull mouth curved unnaturally downwards. She looks pained and humiliated, like a younger sister forced to make excuses for her brother's keg-induced crudeness, and that hurts something in John that can't afford to be hurt anymore. Touching the hand curled tight on the tabletop, he strokes over her knuckles until she releases the fist and brushes his thumb, once, over the damp skin of her palm. Rodney watches them unhappily, opening his mouth to deliver what will certainly be a scalding remark about John's little brain overriding the big one, but John shuts him up with a fierce look.
"I'm 12th generation Bajarian citizen," Ekaterin says, blue eyes fixed intensely on John. "Our friends took my people in when they didn't have to, protected them from the Wraith, not for the safety tax, just because they could. That's the basis of our trust. We love them," she says helplessly. "If over the generations they turned so far inwards in their quest for experience that it was left to us to oversee the safety and security of the people of Bajan, well, we've tried to make the most of it."
"I'm not going to ask how many favored guests you've encouraged to use Bajan as a base of operation," John says wryly. "How many you're arming up or sharing intelligence with, or how many refugees you've smuggled in over the years.
Including, possibly, him." Taylor had first heard of Bajan from a merchant on a busy commerce planet where they'd stayed for a while after leaving Atlantis. Who knew who that man had been?
Ekaterin shrugs, looking down into her lap.
"I'm sure I have no idea what you're talking about," she says, and hides her nose in her teacup.
Walking the streets of Bajan Major on their way to the spaceport, reminded of Ben at every turn. They fed birds in that park. They listened to a live band on that bridge. They bumped into a street preacher on that corner. John watches the crowds of citizens, the stale-faced youths returning from the parlors, weaving and laughing. Bajan's unlikely fifth column. And it could be the loss that's written itself in his cells and divided him from his senses, but he feels a surge of affection for them, suddenly, finds them all absolutely good and brave, and he feels better about leaving Ben here, about not taking his son away from this place where he had been happy. At the gate, Rodney goes through the event horizon first, after thanking Ekaterin stiffly for the tea, and she smiles, arching an eyebrow at John. Denying knowledge to Rodney is kind of like denying food to a starving wraith, John says, a little helplessly.
Is he going to bother you? Ekaterin says, grabbing his arm protectively. Because I know some people who can...
Don't worry, John soothes. It's Rodney. And since that doesn't seem to pacify her, he adds, I'm naturally immune. Frowning doubtfully, she says,
What would you like me to do with the house?
John looks away.
Were you going to tear it down?
No, Ekaterin exclaims. Never.
And John breathes a sigh of relief. He never cared about walls and bricks and plaster, but he never had a home made just for him, either.
Next family that comes along, you offer it to them, he says, looking to the shore.
They'll get some good mileage out of the minnow, and someone should grow up in the treehouse. Also, Rodney's fixed the plumbing.
Okay, Ekaterin says, sniffling. Okay.
And she seems shocked when John pulls her to him. Burrowing into his chest, she tries valiantly to hold back her tears.
What will you do now?
John's a little wobbly himself. I don't know, he says. See if Kolya will let me join a team, maybe. I don't know. There aren't many other things I'm good at.
That's not true, Ekaterin says, sounding disappointed. Besides, Commander Kolya wants you to lead a lot more than a team. He's been grooming you in his own way. You have to know it.
He raised such a hell about Pegasus natives fighting their own wars, and now he's got his own ancient city full of his own people. What does he want with me?
Maybe the commander believes you've gone native enough,
Ekaterin points out shrewdly, before squeezing John's ribs to the point of pain.
You have a home here, okay?
Yeah, John says, his throat on the edge of closing shut.
We learned so much from you. I learned so much from you, she says.
And John wonders if some of his memories went to her, and not the Greys. Strangely, that possibility doesn't anger him.
You have to visit often. You have to not forget us, she says.
Never happen, John says. Ben is always going to be here. When John comes through, Rodney is still pissed at him, while at the same time trying to tiptoe around him, which John can't help but find blackly entertaining. At least dealing with Rodney gives him an excuse to avoid Nofert's solemn eyes that neither ask nor give anything away, and Kolya's blunt yet formal solicitations of John's opinion on anything from city exploration to projected population growth to the assignment of living quarters to next week's menu.
I didn't even know they had the mess running,
John tells Taylor and Ronan while opening the boxes stacked in his designated quarters, looking for pen and paper. He sets a stack of Ben's water paintings carefully aside. Theo has some of these guys trained like Marines.
Good, Ronan says. I'm hungry.
You have bested Kolya twice, Taylor explains, glaring at Ronan humorlessly. To a warrior such as him, it makes you more than a worthy opponent, John.
Makes you an asset, Ronan says, eyeing the boxes marked kitchen. Keep away from Ronan, in Rodney's forceful script.
What's your problem, Shepard? You don't even like taking orders. John refrains from pointing out that he never liked giving them much either, though he'd loved his job and loved the military like family. You could fight with family and not talk for a year. They could call you a slacker and a fuck-up and tell you you'd get people killed, but when the chips were down, they'd still make a place for you in their ranks and their rituals. Above all, he had loved never having to play anywhere but here, because he was always somewhere.
"Do you not miss the pace of your old life?" Taylor had asked him curiously. Well into their first year on Bajan.
I work in the cities and meet a great many people, but you must stay at home to care for Ben, yet you rarely ask for an hour to yourself.
John had almost answered, When you have a kid of your own, I think you'll understand. But it would have sounded condescending, and he didn't know that for a fact. It could have been different for everyone, so he'd shrugged and said, My days are full, and I'm fine, so don't worry. Sitting alone at his desk, trying to compose a letter to his father, John doesn't understand why, out of everything, what kills him the most now is the silence, when Ben had never even spoken a word. He falls asleep mid-sentence, nose mashed against his forearm, and wakes up in darkness to a head full of space and stars and imploding hive ships, and innumerable Bens floating in the cold of vacuum, eyes open and arms reaching out for him. Jolted out of his chair, John remembers what he wanted to tell Kolya, and he runs out of the door, still mostly asleep. His brain catches up to his legs midway to the control room. It's the middle of the third watch. Kolya isn't going to be around, and epiphanies about war and little girls make a lot more sense when one is drunk or hypoxic. Blinking away sleep, he allows his feet to take him the rest of the way, because it beats going to bed to stare at the ceiling and think about vacuum. The skeleton crew watching over the consoles seems inordinately pleased to see him, for people John's never met, and who are most likely Janai. The reason becomes apparent when Rodney walks out of the briefing room, a laptop under one arm, and a steaming cup in his hand. "Ah, there you are," Rodney says, rocking on the balls of his feet. "You realize someone had to keep an eye on the Philistines too, huh? That woman, the praying mantis who's supposedly a scientist, is a menace. She hasn't been here a week, and already she's let her grubby little people shove their grubby little fingers in the environmentals. And would she take the advice of the foremost expert on ancient technology who just happens to be, well, right here? No, she keeps looking down on me, and not just because she's taller. Did you notice this planet has two moons? I think it means double the PMS. I'm not a glass-half-full kind of guy, but I suppose we got lucky. It could have been three moons, or four, or..." "Right," John says, plucking the cup out of Rodney's hand. "That's enough of that." "Hey, that's my private stash." "Beckett isn't around to sew your heart back together after it explodes, so no more coffee." "Oh my God, I forgot how mean you were," Rodney snaps. "I told Elizabeth it was her fault. You kept pushing her to see if she'd hold up, and sometimes she would, and sometimes she wouldn't. And didn't she hear that inconsistent discipline was the most damaging to a child?" "Oh," Rodney says, going pale. "I didn't mean..." "Rodney," John says. "Ah, well, Rodney falters, coughs, and lifts his chin. "What's praying mantis's problem, anyway?" "We destroyed her whole civilization." "Oh," Rodney says, at a loss again. He searches John's face, his eyebrows drawing together. "So, you couldn't sleep?" John grapples for a response, something about the moon and feeling like a natural woman, but it doesn't come. "Do you need to, talk about anything?" "Thanks," John says, shaking his head no. "Why are you still up?" "I'm always up late," Rodney says impatiently, before he concedes. "I have to call Elizabeth. It's a safe bet Ronan is going to stay, and I want to ask for a little more time to explore the city, maybe get her to send some real diagnostic equipment. Also, I kind of told her we were going to infiltrate and blow up a hive ship, and I..." Rodney winces. "Forgot to call her back." "McKay?" I know, but I was with you, and then I was here, and it wasn't a priority, so it slipped my mind." "So call her now," John says, bemused. "Well, I would," Rodney bursts out, waving his arms without dropping the laptop, "but the brainiacs who run this place tell me I don't have the clearance to dial the Stargate." He glares at the Janai soldier standing guard over the DHD. "I have a higher clearance than the President of the United States." "Somehow, I don't think that's going to sway her," John says, stepping across the gallery. "What's your name, soldier?" The Janai comes to attention. "Gunnery Specialist Demira Lanat, sir." "At ease, Specialist Lanat." When she blinks at him quizzically, John explains. "It means you don't have to stand at attention for this conversation." She relaxes dubiously. "I don't want to disturb Commander Kolya. Does anyone else have the authority to grant Dr. McKay use of the Stargate?" "You do, sir," she says slowly, mindful of John's apparent brain damage. "Right," John says. Eventually, Rodney's laptop is plugged into all the right consoles, and all the feeds are set up, and John orders Specialist Lanat to dial Atlantis. Rodney requisitions a couple of chairs, and drags John down by his side, in front of the laptop's integrated webcam. "Atlantis, this is Rodney McKay. Please respond." They don't have long to wait. Instantly, Elizabeth's face appears on the screen, mouth pursed, cheekbones sharp as flintstones. She glares at them ominously across light years. There's gray in her hair, John notices, startled, and something that might be homesickness rises up in him, quickly lost to the entirety of his grief.
Rodney, Angus McKay, I hope for your sake that you have been in a coma for the last 4 days, and that you can produce a written note signed by a medical professional attesting to the prolonged unconsciousness that kept you from dialing the Stargate, while I paced the control room ranting like a madwoman to the point that Carson called Kate. Have I, at any point during our acquaintance, given you the impression that I enjoyed wondering whether you and Ronan were dead? Now, that's not fair, Rodney stutters, looking like he was kicked in the head. Why aren't you yelling at Ronan? Because he's not here? Well, that's true, but hey, he exclaims, yanking John back into the frame. Come here. You deserve way more yelling. There is a moment when Elizabeth seems too stunned to speak, followed by a faint, John? Oh my God, John! And John tries to smile, but his whole face is numb. John! Elizabeth says again, seemingly incapable of getting past his name, which is okay, because John can't get past the tears in her eyes or the break in her voice. Maybe Rodney was right. Maybe things hadn't been as bad as he remembered them. It's really good to see you, Elizabeth says, wiping at her face impatiently. We've missed you. Rodney told us that Ben had passed away. Beckett and his team did everything they could, but I'm sorry, I'm really sorry. I know it can't make up for anything, but please accept the deepest condolences of everyone here for the loss of your son. There is a moment when John feels he'll have to get up and leave the control room or break apart in front of Elizabeth and Rodney and Gunnery Specialist Lynott. But he looks over the consoles and the open Stargate, the faces of the Genii soldiers who surround him, their weapons pointed at the floor, and he brushes his fingers over the smooth skin of the city. Hey, Elizabeth. Waving his hand a little, John finds a smile out of somewhere. Greetings from New Atlantis. End.